just need more time back there? Okay.
No worries, this will be when you're ready.
While we're waiting for the rest of the board members to return to the table, Board Member Smith, would you like to introduce yourself? Can she hear me?
She should.
Yep, hear you.
Okay, would you like to introduce yourself?
Well, my name's Connor Smith. I'm the contract logger representative on the board, and I'm sitting in sunny San Diego right now.
So,
we were just dealing with her motion.
So good to have you with us, Board Member Smith, even if you are probably in a nice little weather situation. So we have a sign-up sheet for a public comment on Type F recommendations. Okay, I'll be asking people to be brief. Kim Miller.
Good morning, Chairman Burnett and members of the board. I'm Ken Miller, representing the Washington Farm Forestry Association. We signed on to Forest and Fish in part to do our share to protect the streams in our care that provide public services and public resources, including fishing. See on the screen, you all have copies of my testimony in your packets. Pretty cool part of being in Washington with our fisheries. We also signed on to help our neighbors maintain their culture and perhaps even building our own legacies of stewardship in the process. Although the focus was on threatened and endangered salmon, we recognized the value and taste of other fish like our native cutthroat trout. We didn't realize, but we accept as part of the deal, we were also expected to protect other fish we'd never heard of, like the mud minnow, stickleback, sculpin, and the Pacific lamprey, and probably a bunch of other stuff I've never heard of. The ongoing water typing discussions are focused on the very small upper reaches of streams, past the nose of the last fish, that don't have any of these fish. But these are areas that might be usable by some kind of fish in the future. On the surface, the debate seemed to be about whether or not to protect these areas. But I doubt anyone is opposed to habitat protection. The underlying debates are really about how much protection, how many trees are needed in these small areas. Despite our skepticism of forest and fish, smalls, like others, are committed to following the science. So where is the science to prove the obvious, in my opinion? Buffer width should be based on the size of streams, the needs of critters using these streams, and the economic viability of those of us protecting those streams. Going forward, we should avoid wasting everybody's resources on mostly academic issues like this one, at least until we know what the science says is really needed. I'm no scientist, but I would bet science would not support 200-foot wide salmon-sized buffers on narrow upper stream reaches for sculpin or likely to be used fish habitat. Smalls forest land tends to be in the lower elevations and on the flatter ground. Smalls forest land with small potential fish habitat is depicted in this LIDAR enhanced photo. the burdens of ramping up our scrutiny and or requirements for fish habitat will likewise fall heavily on small forest landowners. As this type F habitat process moves forward, we want to ensure that the small business economic impact statement process is thorough and at a minimum reaffirms the deference or mitigation forest and fish provides for smalls for our smaller, relatively lower impact harvests. Thank you very much. If there's any questions, we'd be happy to take them.
Thank you, Ken. I'm going to call up three in a group. Norm Shaw, Chris Northcutt, and Nicole Kinsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. I'm Norm Schott. I'm the president of Maryland Ring. We manage about 60,000 acres of timberland, primarily in the Olympic Peninsula, but throughout Western Washington. With me are Chris Northcutt. He's a fisheries biologist that we recently hired onto our staff and assists us in all of our forestry work. And Nicole Kimsey, who's our forestry manager. And she's responsible for all of our harvest unit layout, road layouts, as well as compliance on those activities. And they'll be speaking really about the operational sides of things. Well, I'll be talking maybe a little bit more about the policy concerns as well that we bring. First of all, thank you to the board and to the staff for the presentations over the last couple of days. Well, just seeing it, I think I can be supportive of the proposal that staff brought to you this morning. I like the tenor of it and the ways in which it allows continued work to happen on those items that are not yet resolved and hopefully will be resolved through good review and good science and not with a precluded opportunity to achieve consensus. We, of course, are bound by the rules in all of the activities that we do. We're required to use the default protocols, default habitat assessments, excuse me, or protocol surveys in any of the work that we do. And a couple pages that I just distributed to you indicate the results from 877 actual water type points that have been established by using protocol surveys or default characteristics. These were all done by Chris. So if you have questions about them, he's the guy to ask. He's been out on the ground on every single one of these points, following the approved protocols, and he's a trained and a certified individual and a professional in doing this work. If you turn to the graph, it's probably the easiest way to, it's the second page, to see the results. The blue dots on the graph represent all those points of the FN break, which I know has been referred to and by a lot of people as fish plus. This is not the nose of the last fish, except where that nose ran up against a waterfall. This is going to the nose of the last fish and then going beyond that to the end of fish habitat. That's what those blue dots represent, the average gradient and the average bankful width of every single one of those points. The red X's are the same type of data for those streams that we have said are non-fish. The reason I bring this forward to you is to point out that it will be difficult, maybe not impossible, but difficult to use a model to establish a point that achieves the requirements for accuracy that are within the rules. I'm not a statistician, but I think you could all look at this and not find a single point that you could be 90% accurate in predicting the results of whether there's going to be fish or not fish, or fish habitat or not fish habitat, however you want to look at it. So that points to the need to maintain protocol surveys as part of what we can use to achieve resource protection. That's what we're about within all of this. Without that, there's simply no reliable way of getting it. I want to further point out that every one of these points that is here has been reviewed. It has gone through review by all of the stakeholders, as well as then approved by the forest practices foresters in the established procedures. So this is not something that lacks rigor at all. This is a very rigorous process, again, very professionally done and reviewed by all the players. So with that, as your process moves forward, I just urge you to retain the opportunities for protocol surveys as part of this, not to go 100% reliant on a model, because I think it will be very difficult to achieve. So this being an option. I'd like to turn it over to Chris and to Nicole to talk about how we actually use this stuff in the field.
Good morning, Chairman and members of the board.
Please wait in on the microphone.
I pushed it over towards him on purpose. Good morning, Chairman and members of the board. My name is Chris Northcutt. I'm a field forester and biologist for Maryland Rain. I've been performing protocol surveys as a consultant since 1997. I've performed surveys of the majority of the river systems based in west of the Cascades in Washington. I've pretty much worked for everybody in about every river system. I've got a biology degree, TFW trained, Smith Root course, and 19 years of experience doing the protocol surveys. My opening comment would be, when all said and done, there's no substitute for a trained professional to make a call in the field on an FM rig. There is no substitute for it. I think it's a great starting point to have a model to give you an idea of where to go, but when all said and done, there's no substitute for it. I have people tell me all the time, well, you should just know where it's at. You know, where are you going to put your brake at? I get surprised quite often out in the field with all the experience I have, how different stream systems are side by side, and they can be totally different. You know, the main goal of any surveyor should be to minimize the shocking of where the fish really are and focus the shocking on where they're not to prove absence. There's a lot of effort that goes into the planning of doing a survey that most surveyors that are like myself don't even think about that we do. It's just second nature. You've done enough surveys, that's what you do. Every process starts with pre-consultation with tribes, Fish and Wildlife, DOE. I send out maps every single year for every single place that I'm gonna go, so they know where I'm going. So it starts with pre-consultation with all the stakeholders. The field work gets planned, gets done. You also end with concurrence of all the stakeholders. Not 100% of the time. I mean, you do have a few of them that people have questions about, and you end up with an ID team, and you go out and you look at it in the field, and you come up with an answer. So out on the peninsula, where I do a majority of my survey, we don't have a lot of these problems that we always hear about. And we always wonder about those problems. But the one last thing I would say is, it's an essential management tool that should not be taken out of the toolbox. And if anyone has any questions.
Good morning, Chair and members of the board. I'm Nicole Kimsey, and I work for Merrill Ring. And I've been working for them for 6 years now. And I come from more of the management perspective of getting out in the field and doing all of the layout and the long-term planning for our private timberlands. And I'm going to kind of piggyback on what Chris says here, but what I'd like to really emphasize is that we have always relied on our expert to make a good call in the field. And whether that is our biologist survey expert for streams, or our engineer for our major road projects, or our geologist for stable, unstable slopes, you know, making those calls in the field and using the people that are there day in and day out is so critical. And so, again, reiterating that a model is a great basis and starting point, and default physicals are also a great tool, but the surveying is also an essential tool. I could give you one current example that we have on some of our property. It's a tributary off the Dungeness near Squim. And when you go into where our property is, it looks like it's absolutely fish, and there should be fish presence because it's 10 feet wide and 5% gradient, and it looks like a fantastic place for fish to be swimming. But if you base it on default physicals, you would say absolutely protect this all the way up. But by going down to the confluence of the Dungeness and starting from the bottom up, you run into 50-foot bedrock falls, and from there up is then when we actually perform the survey to see if there's a resident population. And there wasn't in this case, but that's one example of where it's so important to get your feet on the ground and really verify what's out there. An opposite example of that is, again, using the mapping as a starting point, there was a recent harvest that we had done where the FN break was right at the confluence, and then they had it as a non-fish all the way up through our property. It was a small 15-acre harvest, but it had a half mile of stream that cut through the middle of it. And we went out in the field and used that as a basis point, and with the survey determined that there were fish up to our property line. And so we actually upgraded half mile of stream, which is essentially 8 acres of protection that wouldn't have been there because half of that stream is a seasonal flow. So it went from no protection to, whether it was 93 or 105 feet on either side, of protection. So just reiterating the importance of getting your feet on the ground. And not only that, but the collaboration effort on the ground is there. And the pre-consultation is the starting point that we do. And then throughout the survey, and even at the end, if there are questions or concerns of certain areas or certain things that were brought up, we talk about it by phone or email, or we go out in the field and we discuss it and make that determination in the field. So the process is working. The rules and the current guidelines are working for us in the field. And why fix something that isn't broken? Thank you.
Thank you.
If I could just point out one last thing and then we'll get out of here. On the front of the handout are some statistics that come from the data that is put on the graph. And the last point I would want to make is that there have been far more times when we have upgraded streams. That is, we've gone out into the field, either found fish or found fish habitat, and consequently upgraded those streams to type F through the process, through the water type modification process. But very few times have we gone the opposite direction, where something was actually declared fish and we found that it did not need to be called a fish stream. A lot of them may remain neutral, no change, and many were not even mapped and ended up becoming fish streams. That's the benefit of the process that achieves protection.
Hey, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to call Tom Nelson and John Gould up together.
Good morning. You guys all look reasonably well after the shock and awe from elections last night, so. My name is Tom Nelson. I'm the Washington Timberlands Manager for Sierra Pacific Industries. Sierra Pacific is a third-generation, family-owned and operated company. We have 1.9 million acres of land in California and Washington. We operate 13 sawmills. I got to write these down because it changes almost daily. 2 millwork plants, 1 remanufacturing plant, a windows division. And we have 8 cogen plants associated with our sawmills that are capable of producing about 150 megawatts of electrical power that's generated from sawmill byproducts and forest biomass. All of our sawmills are certified under the Sustainable Forestry Initiative, as well as all of our timberlands in both California and Washington, and our wood windows division. We expanded into Washington in 2001, and we currently have 3 operating sawmills here, Aberdeen, Burlington, and Centralia. We manage about 290,000 acres of forest land in Washington, and we're the leading purchaser of state DNR timber sales. We're building a fourth facility in Shelton that should actually start running next month. And we have plans for a fifth sawmill in Pierce County near Frederickson after we're done with Shelton, I should say. Sierra Pacific is a private company, and we could choose to invest any place in the world. People ask us, why did you choose Washington to expand? We see in Washington a level of certainty and stability that we don't find other places. And that stability comes from three general areas. First is the Public Trust Land Timber Sale Program, the DNR Timber Sale Program, where state lands by law must be managed for the beneficiaries of the trust. Second reason is you guys, the forest practice regulations that were formed from the Historic Forest and Fish Agreement. Your regulations were designed to ensure a strong and stable forest products infrastructure as part of the state's salmon recovery program. And the third reason for that stability, or the third reason that we see that stability here, is a solid workforce that's available in Washington, not only in the woods, but also in the manufacturing side. From our perspective, the cornerstone of the Forest and Fish Agreement and a huge concession from the private forest landowners was the 15-year commitment known as RMAP. With this commitment from the landowners, a strong bipartisan coalition passed the original bill, ESHB 2091, that Governor Locke signed into law back in 1999. And with the passage of this, the private landowners were promised a stable regulatory climate so that the potential to convert forest land to other land uses would be diminished and salmon recovery would be enhanced. Lofty goal. Our industry has lived up to our end of that bargain. Since its inception, we have spent over $250 million on RMAP projects to improve fish habitat. As agreed, we made specific investments to achieve our RMAP goals, and we started with the worst first areas and spent funds through both good economic times and, in the past 5 years, the not-so-good economic times. That was part of the deal, and we lived up to our end of the bargain. Our concern at this point is that after expending more than $250 million to improve fish habitat, this board is now considering options that, in our minds, could change some of the original premises of the Forest and Fish Agreement and would actually erode some of the regulatory certainty that we were promised when the law was signed in 1999. In essence, some of the options you're considering could, in fact, form a kind of an RMAP 2, whereby we would be forced to continue the RMAP work and have wider buffers and have fish passable road crossings in areas that are not known to support fish at this time and were not considered in the original RMAP program. This would impose a huge financial burden on us as landowners and would fail to meet the spirit that was agreed to within the original Forest and Fish Agreement. And I say this for three reasons. One, the electrofishing work group found that current protocol surveys are both accurate and safe to fish populations if applied properly. Two, in a recent review of our lands, and John is going to cover this a little bit more, we found that current protocol methods result in the protection of streams for an average of about 500 feet above the point where the last fish was actually found. That's under the current regulations. And three, and you've heard about this already, but I would like to reiterate that the physical defaults are notoriously inaccurate. They will never replace electrofishing for accuracy, nor will they ever meet the scientific standard agreed to in the original Forest and Fish Law, that being 95% accuracy with shared risk of any unknowns. So I'll finish up and turn it over to John by saying that, speaking for Sierra Pacific, when we consider alternatives to invest in forest land or to build new forest products manufacturing facilities, our company views Washington's Forest and Fish Law and the subsequent regulations that you promulgate as being an asset, not a liability. It's an asset that we believe gives Washington a competitive advantage over other states and other countries. And we strongly urge you to maintain this positive historic agreement with the regulatory certainty that attracts forest landowners such as ourselves. Thank you.
So, John, are you going to be briefer than your boss?
Hey, that's one page.
I better ask him.
No, he's not.
Chairman Bernath, members of the board, thanks for giving us the opportunity to speak with you this morning. Again, for the record, my name is John Gold. I am a forester with Sierra Pacific Industries. I'm going to speak to you about two points here this morning. But by way of background, I'm currently a forester in private industry. I've worked in Washington State since 1991 for a variety of landowners, small and large. I've worked in the public sector. I've worked in the private sector from Ellensburg to Maple Falls to Port Angeles to Kathlamet. And that field experience, most of my career has been designing and implementing forest practices projects on the ground, and that's the basis from which I'd like to speak with you this morning. Like most dirt foresters, I feel more comfortable out in the woods than in front of a microphone, but again, thanks for the time here. Also, like most field foresters, I think you find that the passion for this career is honing and using observational skills to assess the landscape, assess all the resources that are present, and then design our projects around all of those resources that public resources that we are entrusted to protect. The first I'd like to talk to you about, and it is submitted in written testimony. I urge you to spend some more time with it. I know your time is limited. But we did hire a third-party consulting biologist to go re-examine water type surveys that we've done over the past 15 or so years. There was a random sample of about 350 water type modification points that were revisited this year to kind of do a report card and see how did they look. Did we get it right? Did we find fish at a totally different place in the watershed? And the results were very positive, and I'll just highlight three things. One is that above the last fish that was found, the point that was proposed through the system, through the water type modification process, averaged about 482 feet upstream. That was 482 feet with no fish located in it, but which we, at the time the survey was done, presumed we might find fish. We deemed it likely to be occupied at other times. The resurvey found mixed results. It found of that unoccupied habitat, only about 50% of the time when we went back and did an independent survey did we find fish there the second go around. We also compared what the physical measurements of the stream were to the presumed indicators of fish use, fish habitat, and we found the physical defaults are really quite conservative. The last fish in our sample was found with bank full widths about between 10 and 11 feet and a gradient of about 13%. Not to say that we don't have streams on our landscape that are 1 foot wide with fish or are quite steeper and have fish. But on average, the real experience from a lot of data out there is that the physical defaults are quite conservative. What I'd like to speak with you here about the rest of my time, and I will be brief, is off-channel habitat and just some of the observations that I've gained from 25 years in the woods and working with this type of habitat. As you know, it's a very valuable, highly productive habitat for fish. It's mostly associated with anadromous species and of course was instrumental species in coming together to pass the Forestman Fish Law. Back in the 90s, we used to call it type 2 waters. It can occur anywhere, but mostly it is found in medium to large streams and rivers, large valleys with complex floodplains, multiple surfaces and terraces. Sometimes it's found where alluvial fans exist. or CMZs exist, and of course, as you know, both of these are protected by other parts of our rules. And also, as you know, in contrast, most of the stream network on forest and fish land occurs closer to the headwaters in confined valleys, mostly has resident fish, and honestly not a lot of off-channel habitat in those very small headwater systems. In my opinion, off-channel habitat is really not difficult to identify and delineate. The use of bank full width as a regulatory metric, and in the past year we began to hear about bank full elevation associated with that. It's what allows foresters like myself and other professionals and fisheries biologists to go out to read the landscape, to look at what's there on a site-specific basis, and identify it in a repeatable and objective manner. Bank full leaves a signature on the soils and the vegetation. It allows us to determine, for example, in the heat of a dry summer like 2015, when maybe there was no water there, which habitats are connected and likely to be used at other times. There are cases where I would freely admit it, it's not obvious, but there are other tools that we use for that. One recent project, we collaborated with two of our tribes and DFW to design an assessment for a planting area with particularly low relief, not a lot of topographic relief, and we designed a wintering sample.